So the question underlying my talk is, do we need topological quantum computers? Certainly a marvelous idea. I'll take it for granted that we want quantum computers, and I believe that eventually we'll have large-scale quantum computers that solve hard problems. So the question is, will the routes to that success take advantage of the properties of topological phases and topological protection? I don't claim to know the answer to the question, but it's an interesting question to consider. So, I'll get out of this. So here's the dream of the topological quantum computer. This is an artist's conception of the exponentially large fusion space of many anions being manipulated by exchange of particles. And here's the reality. There are two candidates known in nature for non-abelian topological phases, and we hope in the near future to have experimental confirmation of that interpretation of these phases. Here's another dream of a large-scale quantum computer, a scalable ion-trap quantum computer. It has many processing units, each of which has a few trapped ions in it, which can be manipulated. 1 and 2 qubit gates can be performed on these ions using pulse lasers. Qubits can be read out with the CCD and so on. And the reality looks kind of like this. There are impressive experiments that have been done demonstrating control of up to 8 qubits in ion trap experiments, but if you visited the ion trap laboratory, you might be skeptical about the potential for scalability. But ion traps are making necessary progress toward miniaturization. And in fact, there are now lithographically fabricated ion traps, which have been filled with ions. Experiments are starting to be done with those. They're noisy, but they're going to get better, and if need be, ion traps could become cold to control the noise and fluctuations due to the electrodes and so on. So there's a potential path to large-scale quantum computing by way of ion traps, but also other technologies. I don't mean to imply that the future necessarily belongs to the ion trappers. There are other approaches to building quantum hardware that are making impressive progress, like spins and quantum dots, superconducting qubits, cold atoms, and so on. But the ion traps have a head start, and some serious thought has already been put into conceiving scalable architecture. So here are comments from 3 of the ion trappers. Andrew Steen, a relative optimist, says ion trap chips look well placed to create useful computers before other methods. Chris Monroe is a little more cautious, saying there is progress, but it's still very slow. And Dave Weiland says ion trappers are encouraged because we can at least see a straightforward path to making a large processor, but the technical problems are extremely challenging. It might be fair to say that ion traps are currently in the lead. However, a good analogy might be that we're leading a marathon race, but only 1 meter from the start line. At any rate, one can imagine this type of technology being scaled up. Now, we all appreciate that large-scale quantum computers are going to require some form of error correction and fault-tolerant operation, both to prevent decoherence and to control the accumulating effects of imperfections in the unitary gates. And without question, topological quantum computing is the elegant approach to the problem in which the hardware is intrinsically robust because of principles of local quantum physics. And we hope that'll work, but it might be hard to realize a quantum computer through that method. There's also a standard approach to fault-tolerant quantum computing where we use clever circuit design to overcome the deficiencies of the quantum hardware. And that too works in principle if the hardware is not too noisy. And either one of these approaches could eventually lead to quantum computers capable of solving hard problems. Which path we follow, and perhaps it'll be a combination of the two, will depend on what turns out to be most feasible technologically, and we don't know that yet. So what I'd like to do in this talk is give some perspective on the non-topological version of controlling quantum computer by reminding you a little bit about the theory of quantum error correcting codes and fault-tolerant quantum computing, and how we can see that once our quantum gates are have high enough fidelity, we can use them to do accurate quantum computing. And then I want to talk about some recent developments in the last year or so, advances in the theory of non-topological fault-tolerant computing, which have boosted our confidence that this type of scheme will really work, and So what is a quantum computer supposed to do? It should, first of all, have a large Hilbert space with a natural decomposition into small subsystems like qubits. We have the ability to prepare qubits in standard states and to measure qubits in a standard basis. And in between the preparation and the measurement, we can perform a quantum circuit, a specified sequence of unitary gates chosen from a computationally universal alphabet, where each one of those unitaries acts on some small number of qubits, like one or two. And we believe that the computational model with these ingredients is more powerful than ordinary classical computation and capable of solving some problems that we'll never be able to solve with ordinary digital computers. The goal of fault-tolerant quantum computing is to accurately simulate the ideal quantum computer that performs these operations using the noisy gates that will be available in an actual device. So how should we think about errors in a quantum computer? Well, if we have n qubits in the quantum computer, the most general type of error that can occur can be represented by a unitary transformation that acts on the n qubit system and its environment. And we can expand the action of that operator on the system in terms of some basis for operators acting on the system. And it's convenient to choose that basis to be the Pauli operators, that is, tensor products of operators in which acting on each qubit we have either the Pauli matrices X, Y, or Z, or the identity. I'm not assuming here that these corresponding states of the environment corresponding to each operator in the expansion are necessarily normalized or mutually orthogonal, so there's no loss of generality writing the error in this form. And now what we'd like to be able to do when such an error occurs is to recover the original undamaged and unknown state psi of the quantum computer. But we can't expect to succeed at that for arbitrary errors. We might, however, be able to succeed if the errors are of a special type. And in fact, we hope that interactions with the environment are reasonably local. So it's reasonable to expect that the errors in the quantum computer are not too strongly correlated. And with that in mind, we can define the weight of a Pauli operator to be the number of qubits on which it acts non-trivially, that is, the number to which X, Y, or Z is applied while the identity is applied to the rest. And if the errors are relatively rare and not too strongly correlated, then the terms in this expansion involving the high-weight Pauli operator should have relatively small amplitude. And now we'd like to be able to devise some recovery procedure which will undo the effects of the Pauli operators, which are of weight which isn't too high. Let's say all the Pauli operators up to a maximal weight T. If we can do that, we'll say that we have the ability to correct T errors in our block of n qubits. So when an error occurs, in general, that will establish some entanglement between the state of our computer and the state of the environment. Become a correlated quantum state. And in reversing the effect of the error, we have to undo that decoherence. And we can't control the environment, but we can introduce some ancilla, which is under our control. And the unitary transformation, which undoes the error, will take the entanglement of the environment with the computer and transform it into entanglement of the environment with the ancilla, which we can then discard. So the quantum error correction routine is a type of refrigeration. Entropy is introduced into the computer by the noise, and we pump that entropy out to the ancilla, which we can then discard or refresh. If we want to use the ancilla over again, we have to cool it back down to close to zero temperature. That's a dissipative process, so it's at that stage that we would pay a power bill the cost of doing quantum error correction. Now, we can't expect to be able to recover from all the errors of weight up to T for arbitrary states in the Hilbert space of n qubits. But we might be able to succeed if the states are contained in a special subspace, a code protected subspace of the full Hilbert space. And if that protected space has dimension 2 to the k, then we'll say that there are k encoded or protected qubits embedded in our block of n qubits. So how should such a code be constructed? One way that works, it's not the only way, but it'll suffice, if all of the Pauli operators that we want to be able to correct, let's say all the errors up to weight T, acting on the code space, take it to mutually orthogonal spaces. And that means that in principle, all the different errors that we want to be able to identify and correct are distinguishable, and it's possible in principle to make an incomplete orthogonal measurement which can identify which one of the errors occurred. And once we know which one occurred, since it's just a unitary operator and we have a quantum computer, we can apply its inverse to reverse the effect of the error. Now, the discussion up to now has been kind of abstract, so let's consider an example. Suppose we want to protect one encoded qubit in a block of n qubits, and we want to be able to protect against all the weight one errors. We want to be able to correct one error. Then there are going to be two basis states for the two-dimensional code space of the protected qubit. And we want to be able to distinguish all of the different states that can be obtained by letting the weight one errors and the trivial error act on those states. So if we chose the size of the block n, the number of qubits, to be 5, then there would be 15 different weight one errors that we want to distinguish, because there are 3 possible poly errors on each one of 5 qubits. And then if we add the trivial error, that's 16 poly operators, which means we're trying to distinguish 16 mutually orthogonal two-dimensional spaces, which will just barely fit into the 32-dimensional Hilbert space of 5 qubits. So in fact, there is such a code that has the properties we want, and we can see that by constructing it explicitly. It's convenient to describe the code as the simultaneous eigenspace of a set of commuting operators, each of which is a poly operator. These are the 4 commuting operators that we can simultaneously diagonalize. They all commute, X anti-commutes with Z, but if I take any 2 operators on this list, there are 2 places where an X collides with the Z, so when I move them past one another, I get an even number of minus signs. Now, to see that, also, each one of these operators squares to 1, so it has eigenvalues plus 1 or minus 1, and we'll take our code space to be the space in which each one has the eigenvalue plus 1. And to see the code does what it's supposed to do, well, one way to check that is to make this table, which describes the commutation relations of these 4 independent mutually commuting operators, with the 15 errors that we'd like to be able to correct, an X, a Y, or a Z acting on each one of the 5 qubits. So for example, I fill out the first row of this table by considering whether X acting on the first qubit commutes or anti-commutes with each one of these 4 operators. And since X commutes with itself in the identity, X acting on the first qubit commutes with M1, M2, and M3, and it anti-commutes with M4. And similarly, I can fill out all the other rows in the table. And then what we observe is that all of the rows are distinguishable, all the rows are different. So if we started out in the code space where each one of these operators has the eigenvalue plus 1, an error which anti-commutes with the operator will flip its eigenvalue. And so if, for example, we measure after the error occurs M1, M2, M3, and M4, and we observe the results, minus 1, minus 1, plus, plus, we can look at our table and see that those measurement results are the signature of a particular weight one error, X acting on the third qubit, and once we know what it is, we can apply it to reverse the error. So how do we actually make these weight 4 operator measurements? We can do that if we have a quantum computer. Here's one way we could do it. We could prepare an extra qubit, an ancilla qubit, that we'll use for the purpose of making the measurement in this state, which is a uniform superposition of a 0 and a 1. And then conditioned on the value of this qubit, we can apply the operator that we want to measure to the block. That is, we do nothing if the ancilla qubit is in the state 0, and we apply m to the block if it's in the ancilla state 1. And then afterward, we measure the ancilla in the basis 0 plus or minus 1, and if we get the plus result, that means the eigenvalue of m is plus 1, and if we get the minus result, its eigenvalue is minus 1. And I can construct that conditional m for each one of these weight 4 operators from a circuit of 4 2-qubit gates, and by performing 4 such measurements, I can diagnose the errors. And if indeed there was a weight 1 error, I can identify what it was. The trouble is that we're going to try to carry out all these operations, identifying the syndrome and performing the recovery, using the noisy gates in a quantum computer. And that raises the issue of fault tolerance. When we carry out this procedure, we might get measurement results that are incorrect. or errors might propagate badly when we perform a syndrome measurement. And remember, we want to do more than just prevent errors. We want to be able to process information. So we have to find a way of performing a universal set of quantum gates that acts on the code space. And eventually, we're going to have to use codes that can correct many errors if we're going to get good performance from our quantum computer. Well, I'm not going to go into the details of how it's done, but we can construct a procedure for doing quantum error correction, which is fault tolerant in this sense. First of all, it does what I already told you. If we're talking about a code that can correct one error, if there's an input to the error correction which has one error, and we perform a perfect error correction routine, we'll be able to identify that error and correct it successfully. But it's also fault tolerant in the sense that if there's a single faulty gate somewhere in the circuit and the input has no errors, the output will have at most one error. So we design our procedure so it doesn't propagate errors badly. And then if we're trying to operate a quantum memory by performing error correction one cycle after another to prevent our quantum information from decaying, then we'll be able to protect the quantum information successfully unless in two error corrections in succession we have at least two faults. In other words, if each pair of consecutive error corrections has just one fault, then we'll always be able to correct an error before it's joined by a second error, which could cause an uncorrectable encoded error. And likewise, we can devise, and I won't explain the details of how we do this either, fault-tolerant procedures for performing encoded quantum gates that act on the code space. And therefore, fault-tolerant means two things if we're talking about a code that can correct one error. It means, first of all, that if our gadget, which implements the encoded quantum gate, is done perfectly and it has an input which has only one error, then the output will have at most one error in each one of its output blocks. And on the other hand, if we have a quantum gate which has one faulty gate in it, and it has an input which has no errors, then the output will have at most one error in each one of its output blocks. And now if we want to perform a quantum computation reliably, we perform our gate gadgets that do the encoded gates, and we follow every gate gadget with an error correction. And then if I consider any one of these red extended rectangles, which consists of the error correction before the gate, and the error correction after. If each one of those rectangles contains no more than one fault, then we'll never have an encoded error, because whenever an error occurs, we'll be able to correct it before it's joined by a second error due to another fault, which would cause an encoded error that we wouldn't be able to correct. So that means if we're trying to simulate a quantum gate, which has altogether a quantum circuit, a quantum computation that has altogether L quantum gates, and we carry out this fault-tolerant procedure that uses a code that can correct one error, then the probability of failing will be of order epsilon squared, because there will have to be one of these extended rectangles which has at least two faults, assuming that the faults occur with independent error probabilities with probability epsilon at each circuit location. Whereas if we didn't use fault tolerance at all, the probability of failure would be of order epsilon. The coefficient here is some combinatoric factor which counts all the ways in which one of these extended rectangles could fail. But the important thing is that as epsilon gets small, the size of the circuit that we can simulate accurately scales like 1 over epsilon squared, whereas it would scale like 1 over epsilon if we hadn't used coding at all. So if the noise is sufficiently weak, using our quantum error correcting code, we will have been able to do the computation more reliably. Of course, we'd like to boost that success to a much higher probability of success, or much closer to one, a much lower probability of failure. And one way of doing that, not the only way, but the easiest to analyze from a theoretical point of view, is to do a recursive simulation. So what I mean by that is I've described so far, in the case where we use a code which can correct one error, how we take a gate that we want to perform in an ideal circuit and replace it by this rectangle, which consists of a gate gadget that acts on the code space followed by error corrections on each one of the output blocks. So I'll call an individual gate a zero gate, and then the ones that act on the code space, one gates and one error correction. Or this is a one rectangle. But now you see I can do this replacement again. The one rectangle is just some circuit with many level zero gates in it, and I can take each one of those level zero gates and replace it by a level one rectangle, and that way I have a two rectangle, which simulates the ideal gate. And then if I make the replacement in the two rectangle of each level zero gate by one rectangle, I obtain a three rectangle, and so on. So the idea of this recursive construction is if, in the first step, when we replace the ideal gates by these gadgets, we improve the reliability of the circuit, then if we make the replacement many times, we can get a big improvement and make the probability of failure as small as we please. If we actually want to analyze this recursive simulation and check that it works, what we need to do is to define a kind of coarse-graining step for a quantum computation, really a kind of renormalization group transformation, which maps a level k computation in this recursive hierarchy to a level k minus 1 computation, to which it is exactly equivalent, but in which the noise has been renormalized. So the idea behind this coarse-graining step is that, as I've said, that if I consider a rectangle which is good in the sense that its extended rectangle has no more than one fault, then that means that the way that rectangle acts on encoded information is correct, that it simulates the ideal gate the way it's supposed to. And the way we make that notion precise is we consider following the rectangle, which acts on a code block, by an ideal decoder, which performs error correction without any errors and then maps the block back down to a single qubit. And when we say that the rectangle is correct, what that means is that we can take this decoder and move it forward so it acts on the input to the rectangle, mapping it down to a qubit, followed by the ideal gate. And if these two things are equal to one another, that means the rectangle is doing what it's supposed to do. So the procedure that maps a level one gadget to a level zero gate is just moving this decoder from the right to the left. And we have a similar notion of correctness for the measurements at the end of a circuit and the preparations at the beginning. So if I look at a big level one circuit, I can materialize decoders in front of all of the good measurements, the good measurement rectangles at the end of the circuit. And then I can move these decoders forward towards the front of the circuit, move them to the left one step at a time. And that will transform each one of the good rectangles to an ideal level zero gate until finally the decoders meet up with the preparations and they will essentially annihilate the preparations and disappear. And that defines our renormalization group transformation. Now, if we want to be able to carry out that procedure again and do the coarse graining again, we have to check that our noise model is really stable under the coarse graining step. So we still have the same type of noise after the step as we had before, so we can repeat the procedure. And in order to get that to work, we have to choose a noise model of the right type. So one of the noise models that we've analyzed, we call local stochastic noise, and it can be described this way, that we have our noisy circuit, the whole circuit, and we can express it as a sum over fault paths, where in each fault path, some of the gates in the circuit are assumed to be ideal, and some of them are assumed to be faulty. And each one of the fault paths is assigned a probability. The defining property of local stochastic noise with strength epsilon is that if I identify our gates in the circuit, and I sum up the probabilities of all the fault paths, such that all of those R gates are faulty, the probability is bounded by the parameter epsilon raised to the power r. Okay. If that property is true, then after I do the coarse graining step, I still have a noise model which can be characterized in the same way, but with a new value of epsilon. And we can't calculate the new value of epsilon exactly, but we can get an upper bound on it. The important thing is that it's of order epsilon squared, because in order to have r level 1 locations in the circuit fail, each one of those has to have two faults in it. And so I get altogether 2 powers of epsilon corresponding to the R failures after I do the coarse graining. And the coefficient that appears here, which I call 1 over epsilon naught, is some combinatoric factor which counts all the ways in which our gadgets could fail. And so since we have local stochastic noise both before and after the coarse graining, we can do it again. And every time we do it, the probability of failure in the circuit per location gets squared. So after k times, the noise strength has become very small, double exponentially small in K, as long as epsilon is less than this critical value that I've called epsilon naught. And because it decreases so rapidly with K, we can conclude that if we want to simulate an ideal circuit, we can do so with a relatively modest cost and overhead. We have a quantum accuracy threshold theorem, which says that there's a critical value of the strength of local stochastic noise, such that if the noise is weaker than that, we can simulate any circuit which has altogether together L gates with some fixed probability of failure using a number of noisy gates, which scales like L times a factor which is polynomial in the logarithm of the size of the circuit that we're trying to simulate. The existence of such a quantum accuracy threshold has been known for a long time, but relatively tight estimates of the threshold that are really rigorous have only been done relatively recently. An estimate we obtained about 2 years ago was this one in the local stochastic noise model of 2.7 times 10 to the minus 5. To derive something like this, certain assumptions are essential. We have to have parallel computation so that you can control noise in different parts of the computer simultaneously. And we have to have a continuous supply of fresh ancillas, because that's how we flush entropy out of the computer. There are other assumptions that we made in this analysis which are not necessary to get a threshold and make the analysis easier, like we ignore the geometry of how the qubits are arranged in space and we assume we could do fast measurements and so on. But I'd like to tell you about four developments over the past year or so, a couple of which have to do with insights that allow us to improve the estimate of the threshold, and a couple of which have to do with relaxing the assumptions that need to be made to derive a quantum accuracy threshold. Well, the first development concerns improving the threshold estimate by using subsystem codes. What I mean by a subsystem code is we take the Hilbert space of n qubits and we decompose it into a direct sum of spaces, each of which is a tensor product of the logical system where the protected information lives, and what I'll call a gauge subsystem, which consists of spectator qubits, which aren't participating in the computation, aren't part of the information that's being processed. The type of code I described before is the special case where the gauge subsystem is trivial, and in that case we could call it a subspace code. And we can always take a subsystem code and turn it into a subspace code by fixing the gauge system in some way. But it's actually desirable in some cases to maintain the gauge freedom. One advantage of that is that because the gauge system commutes with the logical system where the computation is taking place, we don't care about errors in that. So there's no reason to measure additional check operators, which will help us to identify errors in the gauge system, because those errors are harmless. Another thing is that to identify the syndrome that we need to figure out how to correct errors, it suffices just to measure the gauge system, and at least in some cases, it's easier to measure the gauge qubits fault tolerantly than if we have to measure the logical system. Now here's an example of what I'm calling a subsystem code. I've called it the Bacon-Shore code, because it's really the error correcting code that Peter Shor wrote down a long time ago. But Dave Bacon pointed out that it can be usefully regarded as a subsystem code. So in this case, we have a 9-qubit code block, and it's useful to imagine that the qubits are arranged in a 3x3 square array. And we can take the logical operations, the Pauli operators that act on the logical qubits, to be the product, this is the logical x, the product of three x's all in a row on the square, and the logical z is a product of three z's on a column of the square. And the check operators that allow us to identify the syndrome are products of six x's on two rows, or products of six z's on two columns. So what this check operator does, what the x-type check operator does, is it tells us in which row a z error occurs, and what the z-type check operators do is tell us in which column an x error occurs. And that turns out to be adequate information for protecting the logical information that's being processed during the computation. Now, what are the gauge operators, the operators that act on the gauge qubit? Actually, the gauge algebra can be generated by weight 2 operators. So, for example, one of the operators acting on the gauge subsystem is the weight 2 operator that acts on that applies z's to two of the qubits that are in the same row. That commutes with the logical operation and with the x-type gauge operators, and also, check operators. And there's also a way to xx gauge operator that acts on two qubits which are in the same column that commutes with the logical z operator and with the z-type check operators. Furthermore, by measuring the gauge qubits, we can learn what the value of the check operators is. So for example, if I want to measure this weight 6 operator, what I can do instead is measure these three weight 2 operators, zz on two qubits in the first row, then the second row, and then the third row, and the product of the eigenvalues will be the same thing as the eigenvalue of this weight 6 operator. It's actually a big advantage to be able to extract the information about what the error is by measuring weight 2 operators instead of weight 6 operators, because it's easier to make that fault tolerant. So Alatheris and Cross analyzed this type of scheme to see what kind of threshold estimate one can get. Again, one has to essentially count the different ways in which our gadgets can fail. What turns out to be optimal is not this 3x3 code, but a similar code that can correct two errors on a 5x5 lattice. And they improve the threshold estimate to about 1.9 times 10 to the minus 4, about a factor of 7 better than what we had found before in life.
In this example, could you explain what the two types of qubits are, the code and the gauge? I didn't understand that distinction. There are some gauge and some...
Well, so we can characterize the distinction by considering the generators of the poly operators acting on the gauge system and on the logical system. For the logical system, these are the poly operators. Okay.
So these gauge qubits,
we can take two of these z operators, which act on a pair and a row, are independent of the other operators I wrote down, and so are two of the x operators. Actually, there are four altogether z operators that are independent of what I've written down. I could take this zz and this zz, but then this one isn't independent because then I get one of the check operators.
So is there just one code and eight gauge in this line?
Well, you can look at it that way if you want, but I'm distinguishing the check operators from the gauge algebra, although they are generated by the gauge algebra. Okay. So they're all together. There's a logical system, and there are four check operators. That leaves four qubits. And the way to understand those four qubits is that there are four of these ZZ operators which are independent of the other operators that I've described. And those you can think of as the logical Zs acting on four gauge qubits. And then correspondingly, there are four XXs, which are the Xs acting on the gauge qubits. Is that clear?
What's the advantage on acting on things that are outside the code subspace?
Well, it's first of all, they commute with the code subspace, so they don't do any harm.
Okay.
But in addition, they allow us to determine the values of the check operators, because actually the algebra generated by these gauge operators contains the check operators. So the point is that we can get the syndrome information just by measuring the gauge qubits, and they're weight 2 instead of weight 6. Okay, the second thing I wanted to talk about is taking geometry into account. Analyzing the threshold in the case where we have only nearest neighbor gates in some geometrical array. And this was analyzed by Sfori, DiVincenzo, and Terhal in the case of a two-dimensional geometry. So they considered, using a code that can correct one error, embedding a logical qubit on a square array in two dimensions in a cell which is 6x8. And that cell contains a 7-qubit data block, which holds one protected qubit. And those are the qubits denoted D, numbered 1 through 7. And there are also 7 ancilla qubits, which are used for extracting the error syndrome from the data block. And there are 3 verification qubits, which are used to check the ancilla before the ancilla is used to extract the syndrome. And then everything else in the block, which is denoted O, is a dummy qubit. And the reason we have dummy qubits is that we can't safely perform swaps of two of the qubits we care about, like two data qubits or a dig and ancilla qubit, because a bad swap could damage both qubits. The dummies are something that we can safely swap a qubit that we care about, since a faulty gate then will just damage one of the qubits that we care about. And they provide a communication channel by which we can move the qubits around. So in our gate set, we will include, aside from the other gates needed for universality, also the swap gate. And we'll have to construct the swap gate as one of the gates in our recursive hierarchy at each level. And since Nick Bonesteel is going to show you braids that realize a C not gate, I thought maybe, just to be fair, I should show you what a C not gate looks like in this local two-dimensional scheme. I borrowed this from Krista Sfori, and I'm not going to explain all the details of what's going on, but we start out with two data qubits and two adjacent 6x8 blocks, and we want to do a C not between them. But I'm going to include the error correction step that precedes the CNOT, then the logical CNOT, and then the error correction after, because that's going to be the whole extended rectangle that we have to analyze to see how fault tolerant the procedure is. So we start out by preparing an initial state of the ancilla, and then we perform a So we start out by preparing some initial state of the ancilla. We prepare an initial state of the ancilla, and then we perform a sequence of gates. Each one of the arrows is actually a two-qubit gate, and the fat arrows are swap gates where we perform an exchange. And so first we have to prepare state of the ancilla, which is suitable for extracting the error syndrome, and we have to verify it. In this case, the verification actually failed, so we have to do it over again. We verify the ancilla successfully this time. Now we let it come in contact to the data, and then we measure the ancilla, and that's how we extract part of the data syndrome. But it's not all the data syndrome, so we have to do it again and prepare an ancilla again, and then the ancilla comes in contact with the data again, and we measure the rest. So now we diagnose where a weight one error occurred in the block of 7 qubits. Now we want to do the logical CNOT, but we have to perform a sequence of swaps to bring the qubits into the corresponding adjacent position so we can do a nearest neighbor gate to do a logical CNOT between the two blocks. That's taking place in this step. And then we start swapping back, and meanwhile we're preparing the ancilla for the next round of error correction. And we encode the ancilla essentially the same way I described before, and then we let it come in contact with the data and do it again to get the rest of the syndrome. And so altogether there are 61 time steps to give one extended rectangle, the error correction before, the logical CNOT, and then the error correction after. And you can decide whether you think that's worse than Nick's way of doing a CNOT.
Reason to convince us we should go topological, or
sorry,
is that why we should go topological, or
well, I mean, it works. Okay, his way works and this way works, and the only thing that doesn't work is my laptop.
Seems to be going on with all the elements. What you showed us, the board slide, is that one level of concatenation?
That was one level of concatenation. So if you wanted to do this thing at the next level, then every one of the gates that you saw would become a level one gate. And this would be taking place on an array which was 6x8 lattice, actually 2 6x8 blocks of the blocks that I showed you.
That
would be
level,
the next level. Everything's self-similar. So you replace every CNOT in the circuit you just saw by the procedure that I just showed you. And that would
but I didn't remember how many of those arrows were CNOTs.
Whenever there was a two-qubit gate, it was either a CNOT or a controlled phase. Mm-hmm. So most of the gates actually are CNOT gates. The main things that are going on in that circuit are CNOT gates and swaps. So the key thing is to construct the swap at the next level. And we just saw how to construct the CNOT at the next level, and that's what we use in the ingredient to go to level two.
So at level two, roughly, would it be 1,000 or?
Yeah, about that, yeah. Well, so this apparently is the end of my talk.
Microsoft employees.
All right, maybe you're way more business now. Okay, so anyway, you can take the procedure that we just described, and again, you can analyze all the ways in which that procedure could fail due to a pair of faults in the extended rectangle. And by doing so, you can get an estimate of the threshold. And really, the important bottom line of their analysis is that when you take geometry into account, it doesn't have a big effect on the threshold. It makes it worse by about a factor of two. There's some additional overhead costs, some additional polynomial costs in the overhead, but the threshold isn't affected very much. So far, the local analysis hasn't been done with subsystem codes, and when it is, we can expect it to improve further. Well, the next thing I was going to mention is the issue of whether we have to do measurements fast. In the analysis that we did a couple of years ago, we assumed that you could perform a measurement as fast as you can execute a quantum gate. And that might not be a realistic assumption in some hardware settings, for example, spins to quantum dots. It seems that doing fast measurements is desirable because we use the measurements to diagnose the errors, and we want to be able to recover to keep the errors from getting out of control. But DiVincenzo and Alferez showed that actually fast measurements are not so important. And I'm not going to say much about the details of this, but one of the ideas that goes into it is that it's not really necessary for us to get the syndrome information in a timely manner. We might not actually finish the measurements of the ancilla, which tell us what the error syndrome is, until many time steps later, but we'll still eventually get that information. And therefore, we'll be able to infer when logical errors occurred. And even though we don't correct them, it's good enough to know when the logical errors occurred, and then we can take that into account in determining, interpreting the final result of the measurements at the end of the computation. So their estimate is that even if measurements take about 1,000 times longer than it takes to execute a gate, the threshold isn't much affected at all. All right, the next development I wanted to talk about is a further improvement in the threshold, which makes use of error detecting code. Steve?
Does the classical computation power have to live to 1,000 times, 1,000 steps later?
Well, it's an efficient classical computation. You indeed have to do a classical computation which tells you how to propagate the errors through the quantum gates. But all the errors that you have to propagate, it turns out, are poly errors which propagate through gates called Clifford group gates, where the propagation can be studied efficiently using the classical computer. Okay, this is a further improvement in the threshold that makes use of the idea that sometimes we can replace error correction by error detection. That is, it's easier, and therefore we can get a better threshold if we only need to detect that an error has occurred rather than identify exactly what error it was. Now, I've already told you about how we can get a lower bound on the accuracy threshold from using subsystem codes of about 1.9 times 10 to the minus 4. And we'd be able to get a further improvement if, even when we have a noise rate which is above this epsilon naught, we can somehow simulate a gate which has an effective noise rate which is below epsilon naught. Okay? And a couple of years ago, Manny Cannell suggested a way of doing that. And the recent development is we succeeded in putting that idea on a rigorous footing. Cannell's idea is based on this observation, that if I want to perform an encoded gate, a way of doing that is to prepare offline an entangled encoded ancilla, and then doing a joint measurement on the input data and one of the blocks in that entangled ancilla, and that produces in the output block, in the other ancilla block, an output which is the result of applying the desired gate to the input, up to some known poly errors, which are determined by the measurement result. So if we can prepare this ancilla, we can do the encoded gate. And it turns out that we don't have to prepare it terribly well. We can have a pretty high error rate in the qubits and the entangled ancilla when we're done with the preparation, above 5%, say, as long as those errors are very nearly independent, as long as they're not strongly correlated. But the problem is that if we actually build an encoding circuit to make this entangled ancilla, it will typically propagate errors badly. But Cannell's idea was that let's protect the preparation of the ancilla by doing error detection at every step. After every gate, we see if we can detect any errors. And if we can, we abort the procedure and we start all over again. And we don't accept the ancilla that we've prepared until we've gone through the whole circuit without detecting any errors at any step. And then at that stage, we have a encoded ancilla, which is protected by this error detecting code. And we decode the error detecting code, and then we're left with the ancilla that we can plug into this procedure. The idea behind this is that error detection is easier than error correction, and so it has a better threshold. As I told you earlier, if we have a code that can correct one error, that means that our simulation isn't going to fail unless we have two faults inside one of these extended rectangles consisting of the gate and the error correction on either side. But if we're doing error detecting codes instead, it's really the same story, that we're not going to have a failure in the simulated computation unless there are two faults inside an extended rectangle, because only in that case will a second error occur in the block, which will be an encoded error, which will mean that the error will have escaped detection. If the errors are isolated from one another, in other words, we'll always detect the error, and then we'll abort the computation. And this, too, can be boosted in a recursive simulation to a very reliable circuit protected by the error detecting code. But there's a subtlety when we try to analyze the probability of failure in this post-selected quantum computation. What I mean by post-selected is where we accept the ancilla only when no errors are detected. And the trouble is that correlations in the noise can cause big problems in this type of scheme if we don't have some kind of restriction on the correlations. Because what we're going to be interested in is the probability of failure of this big circuit conditioned on global acceptance, conditioned on acceptance by every error detection in the whole circuit. And if the faults are chosen in an adversarial way, that conditional probability, conditioned on global acceptance, could be much higher than you'd naively expect. If the devil wants some gadget inside the circuit to fail, then he could arrange by choosing the faults elsewhere in the circuit to greatly increase the probability that we accept the fault paths that make the gadget fail and arrange that we reject the fault paths in which it doesn't fail. So the conditional probability will be unacceptably high. So in order to get this type of scheme to work, one of the things we have to figure out is what type of noise model will allow it to work. We need a noise model that somehow restricts the global control of an adversary who can decide how to choose the faults to boost the conditional probabilities. But we also need a noise model which will be stable under level reduction so that when we do our coarse graining procedure, we maintain a noise model that has the same properties so that we can repeat the step, the coarse graining step, many times. Local stochastic noise has the property that it's stable under level reduction, that's why we liked it before, but it doesn't place sufficiently strong restrictions on the adversary's control to over the global circuit. But the type of noise model that does work is what we call locally correlated stochastic noise, where we imagine there's a local adversary at each one of the gates in the circuit, and that adversary gets to decide what to do when there's a fault at that location based on messages he receives from other adversaries who are passing messages along. But when there's an ideal gate, a gate without a fault, the messages get erased. And this type of procedure actually does, this type of noise model actually does get mapped to itself when we do our coarse graining procedure. So we can do our renormalization group analysis to see how the noise gets renormalized. And so what happens in that case is that if the noise rate is small, then typically the bad parts of the circuit form small droplets, which are disconnected from one another. And in this locally correlated noise model, we can take the faults and the different bad droplets to be independent of one another. And that means conditioning on global acceptance in the whole circuit isn't much different than just conditioning on local acceptance inside each one of the droplets. And so now we can do the analysis and find a estimate of the accuracy threshold using the error detection idea, and we can get it a little bit above 10 to the minus 3. So this is the best rigorously estimated lower bound on the accuracy threshold that's been obtained so far, But according to Connell's numerical estimates, the actual threshold in his scheme is considerably higher, above 1%, but we haven't been able to prove that. Of course, there's a cost to doing all this error detection, and that is that it's relatively expensive in terms of overhead because we throw away our ancillas with high probability. Technically, that extra overhead cost is just a constant in the sense that it's independent of the size of the circuit that we're trying to simulate, but it can be a prohibitively large constant if the noise rate is pretty close to the threshold. Nevertheless, I think there's a noise regime in which combining the error correction ideas with error detection ideas really does give us a useful advantage. Okay, so one of the questions that I wanted to discuss, I think one of the areas in which we can further improve the theory is to try to make closer contact between the noise models that we know how to analyze and the types of noise that are likely to be present in real systems. From a physicist's perspective, it's natural to formulate the noise in a Hamiltonian language. That is, to consider a Hamiltonian of the universe consisting of the system, our data qubits, and its environment, the bat. The system Hamiltonian is some time-dependent Hamiltonian which describes the ideal computation, and the noise is described by this coupling of the system to the bat. And we expect fault tolerance to work if that coupling of the system to the bat is local, in the sense that it can be written as a sum of terms, each of which acts collectively on just a couple of qubits at once, like one or two. But if that's true, we can now take the unitary transformation that describes the effect of evolving as governed by this Hamiltonian for some finite time, and expand that in terms of fault paths. That is, we can write it as a sum of terms such that we, in the different terms, insert the perturbation in different ways. So in each term, there will be some gates which are the ideal gates because we haven't inserted the perturbation at all, and other gates where the perturbation has been inserted, which we'll have to regard as false. And then if we use this locality property, we can see that if we look at all of the fault paths such that our specified gates in the circuit have faults in them, the operator norm of the sum over all such fault paths, because we'll have to insert the perturbation altogether r times to make our gates fail, will scale like some small number epsilon to the power r, where that we can get a bound on that parameter epsilon is the largest term in the coupling of the system to the bat, the operator norm of that term in the Hamiltonian, times the time it takes to execute one gate in a quantum circuit. And so again, we can consider the recursive hierarchy and apply.
Could you go back to the previous?
Yeah.
So the right-hand side of the equation doesn't seem to include the bat Hamiltonian itself.
That's right. It doesn't actually come into the analysis. That's right. So the Hamiltonian of the bat can be highly non-local, and the analysis is unaffected because what's the key thing here, and that means the noise can be highly correlated,
right
because of the non-local dynamics of the bath. But the key thing here is not that the noise is uncorrelated, the key thing is that the noise is weak, and that every time a location in the circuit is bad, we have to insert the small perturbation. Right, so we can do an analysis of our recursive simulation in this setting as well, and we can see how the noise gets renormalized when we perform the coarse graining step. And we get the same kind of result, which says that the noise gets double exponentially small, which means we can make the effective noise as small as we please, as long as a threshold condition is satisfied, which now has this form, that the operator norm of the system bat Hamiltonian times this characteristic time has to be a sufficiently small number. Now, there are disadvantages to expressing a threshold condition in terms of the norm of the system bat coupling. One reason that's not ideal is it's not something that experimentalists directly measure when they're studying the noise in their devices. And another is that if we wanted to describe the noise as is commonly done, for example, by a coupling to an oscillator path, and formally that norm is infinite, so we don't learn anything useful from this bound.
It would actually, high frequencies? You want to learn?
Well, that's what I'm coming to. The problem is it's the high frequencies that are making the bound seem more restrictive than it should, and we'd like to do an analysis such that that's not true. Right. So it would be more natural if we could somehow express our threshold condition in terms of the correlation functions of the bath, which are something that experimentalists can directly access. And the problem with this norm condition is that really it's saying that the very high frequency fluctuations of the bath have to be small. But intuitively, the fluctuations which have a time scale which is short compared to the time that it takes to do a gate shouldn't be that important, because they should average out over a gate execution time. So it would be preferable to formulate the threshold condition in terms of some effective description of the noise in which the high frequencies are integrated out. And I've been trying to find such a condition, but I haven't succeeded in doing a rigorous analysis of it at time. I think, though, that it's an important problem. Okay, so if I have just a minute, I thought I should say something topological in this talk. So this is kind of switch gears, and I have a question that I want to ask, because maybe somebody here has a good answer. So, well, as you know, if we want to protect classical information, we can use a repetition code where our two encoded bit values are all spins up and all spins down. And we can try to protect a bit by using a system with local interactions. But if we use a one-dimensionalizing system, then our memory won't be stable at finite temperature, because the energy cost of flipping a droplet of spins involves only the defects at the boundary of the droplet, and those defects can diffuse away from one another, which would cause an encoded error. On the other hand, we know that if we consider a two-dimensionalizing system, it is a robust classical memory, it is sufficiently low temperature, because the energy cost of a droplet of flipped spins is proportional to the length of the boundary of the droplet. And that means at a sufficiently low but non-zero temperature, large droplets will be strongly Boltzmann suppressed as the system gets very large, and we have a very reliable classical memory. Now, in the case of quantum memory with just local interactions, the toric code is really analogous to the one-dimensionalizing model, because the energy cost of a chain of errors in the two-dimensional lattice involves only the defects at the ends of the chain. And those defects, even though there's a gap, can be produced with some non-zero rate at any non-zero temperature. And once the defects form, they can drift apart from one another to opposite sides of the sample, which would cause an encoded error. Actually, if we're willing to monitor the defect gas very closely, and even if we can't do that perfectly, we can show that we can correctly infer when an encoded error occurs, so that the probability of an undetected encoded error becomes exponentially small as the system gets large. We showed that some years ago. But it would be much nicer if we didn't have to be watching the defect gas all the time and we really had an intrinsically stable memory. So as with the Ising model, the solution in the toric code is to go to four dimensions. The four-dimensional toric code is the analog of the two-dimensional Ising model in this sense. In the four-dimensional toric code, the encoded operations, in this case, the qubits reside on cells instead of on edges. The encoded operations consist of polyoperators applied to a two-dimensional sheaf of qubits. And now, if a droplet of qubits are afflicted by errors, what will be detected is the boundary of the droplet where there will be a string defect. And so that means that if we consider letting the system get large at some sufficiently small but non-zero temperature, the probability of an encoded error, which requires that a string grow in size to be comparable to the size of the whole system, will be Boltzmann suppressed, and we'll have a very stable quantum memory in four dimensions. So the question is this type of topological error, order, which is stable at finite temperature, meaning the state stored in the ground state manifold remains undamaged except with some exponentially small probability as the system gets large, is it possible in fewer than four dimensions? There's not an obvious exactly solvable model that has this property. In the case of the three-dimensional toric code, we can arrange for, say, the droplets of X-type errors to have an energy cost which is proportional to the boundary of the droplet, but then the Z-type errors will be chains with point-like defects at the ends, and so we'll still have the problem that the defects can drift apart. Or we can do it the other way around, dual, in which we have string defects corresponding to the Z errors, but then we'll have point defects corresponding to the X errors. And the absence of an exactly solvable model makes one or at least a known one, makes one suspect that this type of finite temperature topological order in three dimensions isn't possible. But I don't know whether that's the case or not, and I think it's a question that it might be fruitful to think about. Okay, so I've told you a little bit about the theory of fault tolerance and quantum error correction and some of the recent developments that have advanced the theory. I've said a little bit. Actually, I realized because of lack of time I couldn't talk about one of the questions, which is, can we take advantage of the properties of many systems that the some types of errors are more common than others? But anyway, there are still important questions to address in the theory of fault tolerance. But as the theory advances, I think it's becoming more plausible that these methods can be used to protect large-scale quantum computers without explicit topological protection. You know, don't get me wrong, I love topological quantum computing. I've been madly in love with it since Alexei first told me about it. That's 10 years ago now. And I'm still in love with it. But certainly a question for us all to ponder, whether topological protection is going to be the key to getting large-scale quantum computers to work. Okay, thanks for listening.